Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the battle between Republican legislators and Governor Wolf over the state's COVID-19 disaster declaration. But up front, the death of George Floyd while in police custody in Minneapolis almost 3 weeks ago has done more than provide a focus on police treatment of African Americans. It has put a spotlight on other issues of racism or racial disparity. Health and health care are two of them, and the coronavirus pandemic is an example. African Americans are more likely to encounter the coronavirus, less likely to be tested for it, and more likely to die from it. These realities are fueled by what panelists at a state Senate hearing last week said is a pandemic of racism that has afflicted American public policy for decades in areas from education and employment to housing and health care. As a result, these experts say, African Americans face a disproportionate risk both to contract the virus and to have underlying health conditions that exacerbate its effect. Joining us on this segment of today's program is Democratic State Senator Art Haywood, who represents parts of Philadelphia and Montgomery County. Senator Haywood, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very glad to be on.
Also joining us is Children's Hospital of Philadelphia pediatric attending physician and National Medical Association officer, Dr. Priscilla Posse. Dr. Posse, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me.
And our third guest is former Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Calvin Johnson. Dr. Johnson, good to have you on the program today.
Good morning. Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Johnson, let me start with you. African Americans are more than twice as likely to die from the COVID-19 virus than whites. Why? What are the factors that are leading to a higher proportion of blacks dying from the virus than whites?
Well, Scott, the fact of the matter is that we know many of the reasons, but we probably don't know all of the reasons. And so we start by talking about those that we do know. You know, and part of the fact is that African-Americans are likely exposed to this virus more often than others. And that's one clear reason why they're likely to be more likely infected. They're the frontline workers disproportionately in our economy. They drive the buses. They serve the food, they clean the hospital rooms and provide healthcare services. They do many of the jobs that have not allowed to stay home during the period where many of us are able to do things like this and take calls and work from the safety of our homes. They have to leave home every day to work in order to pay their bills and provide for their families.
You may have answered this partially, but let me follow up. It was pointed out at the Senate hearing last week that 7 weeks ago, whites and people of color were dying at about the same rate from the coronavirus. What's happened since then?
Well, you know, that was an interesting point. It was raising an interesting question because part of that has to do with the fact that, again, during the time that we found that one of the most effective means of slowing this virus and stopping its spread and keeping our distance and staying apart, i.e. staying at home and sheltering at home. And many are not able to do that. 1 in 5 African Americans, 1 in 6 Hispanics have jobs that do not allow them to do that. But in addition to that, Scott, testing has been a process by which cases are identified, and so in that course of time, there's been a change in the testing amount and probably who's being tested. And without knowing that, we really don't know what all the factors are that go into telling us why case amounts are different over a period of time.
Well, you mentioned in your first answer, Doctor, that there are a lot of factors that go into this. Some are short-term having to do with this particular pandemic. but there are others that have been around for hundreds of years and part of systemic racism when it comes to healthcare and how African Americans are in the system or treated or their those comorbidities. And we'll talk about as many of those as we can. But that testing issue has become one of the acute issues here in Pennsylvania. That I've seen a statistic that depending on the zip code you're in Philadelphia, for example, that, you know, if you are in a zip code that is predominantly African-American, you're a lot less likely to be tested than if you're in a zip code that has mostly Caucasians. Is that accurate?
Well, there was, that's based on some work done by an epidemiologist out of Drexel University, and certainly is a concern, remains a concern, who is being tested. You know, part of this is it's incredibly important to let data drive the decisions that we're making around the efforts and the interventions to stop this virus. And without knowing who is being tested, i.e. reporting who's being tested by key demographic factors, in particular race, we really don't know who is, in fact, getting tested. If you look at the locations of the testing sites at that time, yes, absolutely. If you looked at testing sites, they were most likely set up in areas that were less accessible to people without automobiles or using public transportation, where necessarily when you look at the zip codes, it's very clear and easy to determine what the predominant demographic makeup is of those zip codes. So that is certainly the case at the time. Now, testing has increased, which is a good thing, but we still do not know who is actually being tested.
Senator Haywood, this would seem to be, and I mean this being the testing issue and where testing is occurring and how often it is occurring, would seem to be something that could be done legislatively, that some changes could be made. Is there anything happening right now in the legislature to reach out and ensure that more people of color are being tested?
Yes, although it's not enough, but there are a group of African-American doctors, the Black Doctors COVID Consortium. They've done testing on a volunteer basis without any government support for 2 months, and we are trying to get some public support, some grant dollars to them so they can continue to do this testing. They have received a grant from the city of Philadelphia so they can continue their work, but much more needs to be done so that trusted individuals will be the ones doing the testing, because we know that there is a differential between folks getting services from those who are trusted and those who are not, which is why it's so important we get some African-American doctors, some Black and Brown doctors engaged in this activity. And they are engaged. We just have to make sure we fund them.
Senator, you know, it seems though the state has, let's face it, this has moved quickly. It has been unprecedented in many ways over the last 100 years. But it seems as though the state is reacting rather than being proactive. And I think about the cases in nursing homes and assisted living facilities, that so many deaths have occurred in those facilities. The state finally has made some plans to get more testing done, in fact, universal testing in those facilities within the next month. But here we are again when we're talking about in some of the places where African-Americans, that African-Americans are not being tested as much as Caucasians, for example, that we're still reacting rather than being proactive. Is it just that this happened so quickly, or what?
So I think in terms of the testing, I would describe this as very much as this is something that happened very quickly, as well as even in the nursing home environment. It was all of the actions of the government were mostly reactive. However, I don't think we have to be there going forward. Going forward, what we can do is have a pandemic response that is more inclusive in terms of the team that comes together to decide what needs to be done. One of the recommendations from the hearing was that we create local task force and state task force to look at the disproportionate Black dying, so that we can come up with local and state solutions. I believe that is exactly what we need to do.
Now, what this task force would do what? Okay, when you say finding local and state solutions, what would this task force do? And time is of the essence here, so how quickly would this task force work?
So on the time question, I would want to say that this has been a 400-year challenge in terms of the treatment of African Americans in the nation. So the pace of this, we should be as intentional as we can, but this is a long-term struggle. But in terms of the activities of these task force, one, they can begin to get the data, the demographic data, and demand the demographic data so we can say who is not tested. Two, we can make sure that we create some points of access so that individuals who want to get tested and get treated get the access, whether that be through a hospital, whether that be through a health clinic, whether that be outpatient. That system needs to be further refined. Had a significant discussion in the hearing about broadband access. Telemedicine has been a key way that people are getting services now. There's a big digital divide in the Commonwealth, and urban areas don't have the same access as well as rural areas. Some don't have access. So we've got some legislation looking at how we can cure the broadband challenges. So those are some of the issues, not all, that these task forces can look at. But without a concentrated effort of leaders who are concerned and dedicated, we will not be in a better position when this virus or any other pandemic comes around again, which we know it will.
Senator, you said that the state needs to collect demographic data. Why hasn't that happened? Why didn't it happen from the beginning in Pennsylvania? Other states were collecting demographic data. Pennsylvania wasn't until recently.
I would say it goes back to your point of being in a reaction mode. Now, there are a number of states, and I got to tell you, I believe it's the minority of states that have actually collected the demographic data. I think Dr. Johnson mentioned there were possibly less than 10 or so that had done it. And and we're behind the curve. There's no doubt about it. This is something that we can correct. But if you ask me why it happened, I believe it's entirely because of the nature of the reaction to a pandemic for which we were not prepared, for which the national government did very little to help each of the governors across the nation.
Dr. Posse, you are a pediatrician. I know that one of the things you talked about at the hearing last week was children, African-American children, and some of the health care that they don't receive as they're growing up to become adults. How does that contribute to not just this coronavirus issue that we're dealing with, but healthcare, health overall amongst African Americans?
Right. It's a great question, Scott. So first, in the setting of COVID-19, as a pediatrician, you know, the first message that was being sent out to all of our families, all of our community constituents was stay at home if you can. This is going to help limit exposure. It's going to help limit the spread of infection. What was lost in that message is for those, especially children, who do require regular health maintenance, you can still be seen by your provider. A lot of our practices have implemented safe precautions where you can come and still see your pediatrician, where everyone is given a mask, where we are decreasing the amount of families in the weight room. And so initially, there was a large decrease in the children that we were seeing. So we know that children every day that are living with conditions such as asthma or ADHD, epilepsy, or sickle cell, those children are receiving great care and are able to live daily and healthy lives. And so when they're not being seen by their pediatrician, that's a concern that their health and well-being is not being as well maintained. Then we also think about children with special health care needs who also require some unique assistance and health care in that regard, and they're not being seen as well. And so when we think about health maintenance during this time, it's regular contact with the pediatrician and being seen when needed and making sure you're getting your medication and treatment. As we think about going forward from a COVID-19 perspective, it's how do we make sure, as you say, Scott, especially our children in the African-American communities, are we making sure that they're still receiving health insurance, right? So we know that in these communities, they're less likely to be insured. So we have to make sure that we're expanding Medicaid and CHIP to make sure that all children are receiving access to health care. Are we making sure that our medications are affordable so that children who have asthma or ADHD are getting their medication regularly? And there's a school component as well. Some of these conditions are exacerbated by schools, whether it's asbestos and mold in the schools as well. Are we making sure those schools are clean so that children are not having asthma exacerbations while they're there? So it's a twofold dialogue for us as pediatricians. It's making sure that our children are receiving care during this time in the pandemic in a safe and healthy way, and then also that we're making sure that we're having parameters that are ensuring that they're getting their long-term maintenance over time. And then lastly, I will say as well, is that we also want to make sure that we're able to prevent possible health concerns post-COVID, right? So as children are staying home, they're not as active, they're not outside, they're not getting access to more nutritious foods. And so we're concerned about a rise in obesity. Children are at home. They're socially isolated. They're not able to engage with their peers or participate in activities. We're now seeing a rise in anxiety and depression. So from a pediatric standpoint, we are trying to make sure that our children are receiving health and maintenance today. But we're also trying to make sure that we're having a framework to provide them good and healthy access to care post-COVID, and then also prevent preventable disease long-term.
Yeah, and I want to talk about both short and long-term in just a moment. You have to take a break here. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. During this portion of today's program, we're talking about why the COVID-19 coronavirus has struck the African-American community especially hard here in Pennsylvania and across the country. Our guest during this portion of the program is former Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Calvin Johnson, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia pediatric attending physician and National Medical Association officer, Dr. Priscilla Posse, and Democratic State Senator Art Haywood, who represents part of Philadelphia and Montgomery counties. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Posse, I want to follow up with what you were saying just before the break. The point you were making about so many children being at home when this first started, there still are some at home. Now that we are in summer, there are no longer classes. But you seem to be making a great case for telemedicine. And as Senator Haywood said, telemedicine can't happen in many ways if there isn't the expansion of broadband. Talk about those things, if you would.
Yes, absolutely. So telemedicine has been a great way for us to stay connected to our patients. And so telemedicine would be the same as an in-person visit where we're able to make a phone call. You can use video call if you have that option on your phone. And we're able to dialogue with the parent and see the child. It's really important as a pediatrician that we lay eyes on the child. Their behavior, their interaction can really tell us a lot about what's going on, whether it's their regular maintenance of care or if we're starting to see signs of anxiety or in some circumstances, unfortunately, abuse. We're able to really lay eyes on the child and get a sense for that. But we can also interact with the parent. We can also ask them, how are they managing at home? We can identify potential stressors and how can we navigate in that way. I will say with telemedicine, as we start to advocate for physicians to be able to use this more in this type of setting, we have to make sure two really important factors is one, that when we're thinking about telemedicine, that we're ensuring that the reimbursement is equitable to an in-person visit, right? So they're receiving the same quality of care. And so we need to make sure that our physicians are being reimbursed at that value. And two, we have to make sure that all of our families are able to engage in telemedicine. We need to make sure that they have telephones. We need to make sure that they have access to internet if that's the way that they're able to conduct that visit. We think this will be a way that we're able to see actually more children, especially those that have more chronic or coexisting conditions. We can see them more regularly. And then this also then will allow us to reserve those in-person visits for those that need to be seen acutely or be seen in a physical visit. And so telemedicine, we think, is certainly the way to go. We hope that it's a way to stay, so long as that, again, we're seeing the reimbursement on the back end from our insurers, and then also that our families are able to participate, engage in a way that's equitable across all socioeconomic demographics.
Senator Haywood, you mentioned expansion of broadband. This has been a bipartisan issue. I think both Republicans and Democrats in the Pennsylvania legislature, and certainly Governor Wolf, over the last 3 or 4 years have said we need, it is a must that broadband be expanded here in Pennsylvania. The problem has been how to pay for it. Now, Governor Wolf came up with a plan that would involve taxing natural gas drilling. Republicans don't want anything to do with that. So in this, what has changed that you feel that maybe there is more of a possibility of getting some bipartisan support for expanding broadband here in Pennsylvania?
I had a conversation with my colleague, Senator Christian Phillips Hill, on the floor this week about this very topic. She's the leader of the legislation for expanding broadband. It's primarily for rural Pennsylvania. We had a good conversation about the need to do it also in some of these urban areas. So I believe that we have the foundation for some bipartisan support to look at how we do the expansion, how we pay for it, whether Verizon pays for it or Comcast, and how much the taxpayers pay, how we share the burden for paying for it, obviously is a key issue to be resolved. But this is a matter where I believe that, based upon my conversation this week, we've got some emerging bipartisan support to get it done. And like anything else, we got to pay for what we want. Systemic racism will persist unless we pay for the changes that it will take to end it. Ending systemic racism will not be free. It will not come at no cost. So there are costs associated with it. We've got to commit to those costs.
There are certain things that Senator Haywood has mentioned that can be done short term to fight this disparity in African Americans dying from COVID-19. But overall, this is something that has been going on now for hundreds of years as far as health and health care of African Americans, the disparity. Dr. Johnson, what has to happen? I mean, that can't be tackled in just a legislature in just a few weeks. What has to happen to change that?
Well, you know, no, it can't be solved 400 years of more of this in just a few weeks in the legislature. But the very specific types of actions that the Senator talked about and addressing the disparities that exist right now, right here with the illness and death of COVID-19 disproportionately impacting African Americans and people of color can, in fact, make a difference. If we're addressing some of the issues right now that have been barriers to people getting tested and people getting timely care in COVID-19, what we're doing is beginning to address those structural issues and institutional issues that have prevented people of color from getting timely care for their diabetes, for their heart disease, for many, many years as well. So the two really are not separate and apart, and what I don't want anyone to feel is that that this is such a big issue and so overwhelming that we become paralyzed and unable to act.
Do you think that's happened before? Do you think that's happened before?
I think it's happened over and over again, both in terms of honestly feeling overwhelmed and also in terms of using it as an excuse not to act. And so it's time for to put those excuses aside. We have a crisis that we very clearly see is disproportionately affecting parts of our community, and people in our community that it's not affecting in an isolated way. For example, if it's affecting people in African American communities and they're not able to continue to work and help us drive our economy forward, because our economy does not work without those frontline workers we talked about, then it's affecting everyone. So this is not isolating the impact on folks. It is disproportionately impacting folks, but we absolutely all are going to be impacted across this state and across this country. So yes, it's happened before, but this is a real opportunity to stop that now and pay attention to those issues that immediately protect the health and safety and well-being of some of our most vulnerable populations, that the data tells us of being affected that way now. And it's also an opportunity that will pay dividends and benefits to dismantling those structures and reinforcing those infrastructures that have been detrimental to disparities, and those infrastructures that actually can benefit in eliminating disparities going forward.
So what is the opportunity, the coronavirus pandemic or the light being shined on racism or, racial disparities over the past 3 weeks, or both?
In my opinion, I just want to jump in quickly. The protesters have created a tremendous opportunity for addressing systemic racism, all racism across the board. And this movement is in rural Pennsylvania, urban Pennsylvania, small towns. We got a moment here to mobilize ourselves against racism, and we should use it on all fronts in which racism appears.
Would you agree, Dr. Johnson?
I would.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that I think about, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying, Dr. Johnson, about now having an opportunity and focusing on these things. We as a country very often have a short attention span. Obviously, the coronavirus pandemic dominated for 2 months. Then there was the death of George Floyd and the subsequent protest over the past 2.5 weeks. I just wonder, though, what happens if there is another large news event that the media attention goes to something else? Does it do what you had suggested or described a few minutes ago, Dr. Johnson, that we missed this opportunity?
Well, many years ago when we had an outbreak of hepatitis here in Pennsylvania that actually kind of reached across the country and around the world in scope, I talked about the media being a key ally in public health by helping to get accurate information out and raise awareness. The idea that we tend to chase kind of the next shiny thing,
yeah,
and feed into this idea of short attention spans of the population really is not helpful. American people can do more than one thing at a time, and we can handle multiple complex issues at a time. That's how this country was built. And so staying focused, reporting today's news, but staying focused on the issues that really do and can improve the way of life for everyone in this country is something that we all can do as partners in this. And we don't have to just chase the next shiny thing.
Senator Haywood, government isn't the solution to everything. But I'm curious, at this time, are both black and white, Republican, Democrat, are they focused on these issues?
I would say certainly black and white are clearly focused on these issues. In terms of party affiliation, there's still a significant lag in the attention of the Republican Party in the United States. And I think that's largely because we got a president of the United States who is a Republican, who is the chief racist and encouraging racism and division. And so it's going to take a while for the Republican Party to disassociate itself with the president. And so I think it's going to take a while for them to catch up. But the protesters are doing everything they can to help eliminate party affiliation as a reason for blocking racial justice. But the president is a big problem because he's creating an alignment toward racism, and now all the Republicans have to manage that.
But, Senator, I have to point out, and this is just an observation, that when you say things like that, there will be Republicans that may be, I don't know, sympathetic to what you're looking at, will say, well, he just used some divisive language to describe the president, and it doesn't help your cause.
I think it helps it tremendously because it provides an opportunity for Republicans to disassociate with the president and align with everyday people. So I think it's extremely helpful to help people understand that in a scale of 1 to 10, that they can choose to be with the 10 or they can choose to be with the 1. So I think helping people understand what's at stake is extremely helpful. And it makes it a lot easier for Republicans to say, at this moment in time, I am not going to be aligned with a racist president. That is something that I think is possible to do, easy to do. Well, maybe not easy, but definitely possible to do. And the more we make it clear that there's a choice that can be made toward people, the easier that choice can be made.
We're almost out of time for this segment of the program. I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Senator Haywood, I'll let you have the last word. What has to happen here, at least in the short term, to make sure that there are African-Americans and other people of color being tested and that somehow that disparity is at least being addressed?
In the immediate short term, we've got to get funding to the African-American physicians and trusted physicians and organizations to do the testing. These organizations exist. They are in the community, and we need to support them with public resources to do the testing. The second thing we need to do is get this demographic data so that going forward, we know where the gaps are and then are in a position to address the gaps as opposed to, as you have said at the outset, just merely reacting. These are two things that can be done immediately and that we should do.
Democratic State Senator Art Haywood, who represents parts of Philadelphia and Montgomery counties, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia pediatric attending physician Dr. Priscilla Posse, and former Pennsylvania Secretary of Health Dr. Calvin Johnson. Thank all three of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. A legal battle is brewing in Pennsylvania over the disaster declaration by Governor Tom Wolf that effectively shut down the state to manage the coronavirus outbreak. Republican lawmakers say the declaration has damaged the Pennsylvania economy unnecessarily because restrictions were placed over the entire state rather than in counties with large outbreaks. Republicans have conceded that the declaration was warranted in the early days of the crisis, but say it is not any longer. They have passed a resolution demanding an immediate repeal. But Wolf plans to extend the state of emergency, along with dozens of emergency executive orders that came after. The governor says that he will veto the resolution, and legislators say the governor doesn't have the authority to do that. Joining us, and this is going to be a legal discussion, joining us now is state and federal constitutional law expert Bruce Ledowitz, professor of law at Duquesne University School of Law. Professor Ledowitz, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Professor Ledowitz, what is the actual legal question being presented in the court here?
There are two legal questions. One thing is, does the statute, the Emergency Act, under which all of the governor's orders have been issued, does that statute require the legislature to submit, that's the term of present, to present this resolution to the governor for the governor's potential veto? That's a statutory question. And, of course, I should remind your listeners that if the governor were to veto the resolution, it would almost certainly be upheld. So it does change the outcome. In any event, the first question is statutory. Under the statute, what's the law? The second question is, if the legislature does not have to present to the governor, is that non-requirement constitutional? Since the Constitution does say, in Article 3, that all resolutions shall be submitted to the governor.
Well, then, from you, what you've laid out seems pretty cut and dried. You said that the governor's veto would almost certainly be upheld. So what's the issue?
Well, the Republican leadership reads the statute differently. The natural reading of the statute is that they don't have to submit this resolution to him, that it's effective in and of itself under the statute. And then the question of the constitutionality of that requirement is a separate question. And here, the governor has to be exceedingly careful, because if he argues that a part of this statute, the emergency statute, is unconstitutional, he runs the risk that a court might strike down the whole act, thus removing all of his authority to issue any orders at all.
It would seem as though, and for many laymen, legal terms are, you know, a foreign language anyway, but it would seem as though the language in these statutes is not that clear. And so you could find a court that would rule either way. Am I accurate in saying that the language is not clear and that's why both sides can read it the way that they feel is an advantage to them?
Well, actually, I think that the Republican, and it was bipartisan, but it was mostly the Republicans who passed this resolution. I think the Republican argument on the statute is the stronger one. I think if you read the statute as a whole, this resolution was obviously a check on the governor's power to extend a declaration of emergency. And what would be the point of having a check like that if the governor could then veto it? So I have a feeling that they're right on the statute. On the other hand, the governor has a strong argument on the statute because you're supposed to read a statute to be constitutional. So to imply presentment if it would otherwise be unconstitutional would be a reasonable thing for a court to do. And then, Scott, you have the added problem. What court wants to really take away all the authority of the governor to do anything at all under this pandemic? I mean, the virus has not gone away.
And the points that you make are really strong points in that, our government is a system of checks and balances. I'm assuming that this was written in 1967 when Pennsylvania's last constitutional convention, but that this would have been written so that those checks and balances would be put in place. But at the same time, the governor has to have some power to be able to declare a disaster emergency. And we can probably talk about this a little bit more, but Governor Wolf has pointed out that there are a lot of things that could happen that would put the state at a disadvantage if this disaster declaration was repealed.
Well, and that's absolutely true. For example, and of course the Republican leadership is aware of that. They're assuming that some of the rules would stay in place under the Secretary of Health's other authority. So our legislature is not being completely irresponsible here. They are not suggesting that we should have no rules at all. But it is true, for example, Governor Wolf issued an order a few weeks ago that gave immunity from suit to healthcare workers under the conditions of the emergency, so that if a doctor has to do something that the doctor really should not do because of the emergency, you cannot sue the doctor. You know, everybody knows that's a very important order, and nobody wants to see that taken away. But, of course, if you strike down the whole statute, even if you withdraw the emergency declaration at this point, that protection goes away, too. It's just one example.
You mentioned about courts maybe not wanting to tackle this issue or at least overrule a governor. Both sides here, they want a fast resolution, and I'm sure many Pennsylvanians do as well because their lives are being directly impacted by this.
Well, I know that both sides say they want a quick resolution. I'm not so sure.
Oh, really?
Because I have a feeling that if the Republican leadership had really wanted a fast resolution, they might have asked the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to exercise its King's Bench authority, in which case you could get an immediate resolution. By going to Commonwealth Court, not that that would necessarily have worked, and I'm not speaking, Scott, out of any special knowledge. I'm just looking at the situation and wondering if there isn't a little political theater going on. You know, in other words, everybody might be happy if the status quo just sort of stays in effect for a few more weeks, and that may be exactly what happens. How much of a hurry is Commonwealth Court going to be to dig into this?
Professor, I have to just add here, you think that there's a chance of some political theater? I know that's hard to believe, but maybe, and we have to understand that, you know, not everyone knows exactly how these courts work. Difference between Commonwealth Court and the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania.
Well, the King's Bench Authority is special jurisdiction that Pennsylvania has. Not that many other states have it. It allows the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to step in and immediately resolve any really pressing issue at any level of our judicial system. And so, for example, the original challenge to the governor's authority to issue orders under the statute was brought under the court's King's Bench power, or attempted to do so. When there is a really pressing matter, as this is, and you need an immediate resolution, it's quite normal to ask, at least, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to decide it right away, especially since under the this is a purely legal argument. It's not like they need to develop an evidentiary record. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court could, in theory, decide this issue tomorrow. I'm just not so sure, Scott, that people are in that much of a hurry.
But if either side is not in that much of a hurry and there's the status quo, what resolution is there?
Well, you know, most people are going to continue to follow the rules. Either because they're not sure that they've been removed, or because they will be subject to civil liability if they're a business for not following these suggestions, even if they're only suggestions. You know, if you take the position, you run a business, you say, oh, the legislature's removed the governor's power, now people can come in without masks, even though you know the governor and the Secretary of Health are still recommending masks. If somebody gets sick, not only are you liable, but your insurance is not going to cover that. So that kind of recklessness, I don't see it unfolding very much. Now, of course, you know, people have a right to say, I want to know if I'm subject to these rules or not. But if you read the statute carefully, the resolution that the legislature passed is not self-executing. That's a term in law. The statute says that upon receipt of the resolution, the governor issues an executive order removing the declaration of emergency. Everybody agrees that the governor has not done that. I mean, of course, he may be acting unlawfully, but he has not done that. So I think even under the statute, the orders are still in effect.
There's a word in the statute, and there are many other cases I'm sure you're aware, and you probably could point to some, that the Republicans have seized upon, the word shall.
Right.
About that and why how it pertains to this case.
Yes, because the statute says that upon receipt of that dual resolution and without presentment, that is, without an opportunity for veto, the governor shall issue an executive order ending the declaration of emergency. The Commonwealth Court years ago was faced with a similar kind of issue in a death penalty case. Governor Casey had refused to issue any death penalty warrants. I mean, he denied he was refusing, but he didn't issue any. And the death penalty statute used the word shall. Under certain circumstances, the governor shall issue a warrant of execution. Commonwealth Court took the position at that point that the word shall is binding. And they were willing to order the governor to issue the warrant, the death penalty warrant. In a lot of other states and in the federal system, a court might hesitate to issue an order like that because of separation of powers concerns. Pennsylvania apparently would take the position, if the leadership is right about the meaning of the statute and if it's constitutional, the courts of Pennsylvania might very well order the governor to issue the order, and he would undoubtedly comply if ordered.
So it would seem as though that word shall is going to be very important in this case, and there is some precedent.
Right. That's absolutely true, but remember, the dual resolution has to be effective. So if the resolution is not effective until it's presented to him for a veto, potential veto, then he can say, I haven't been ordered by the legislature because they haven't complied with the procedures of the statute. That's the position the governor's taking right now, for example. He doesn't deny that the statute could be binding. He's denying that they've complied with it.
Something that you referred to earlier about how, you know, both sides can make an argument in this case. Refers to a legal term, severability. What is severability,
right,
and how does it apply in this case?
Well, this is the problem for Governor Wolf. The statute on its face does not require presentment. That's why the Republicans start off with the wind on their at their back on the statutory argument. Governor Wolf is saying that the Constitution requires that all resolutions be submitted to him for a possible veto, and that therefore that should be read back into the statute, even though it's not literally mentioned. You know, like a statute doesn't mention free speech because we already know that we have free speech. Well, fine, but if the court goes one step further and says, no, the statute does not require presentment, but you, Governor Wolf, are right that it has to, therefore, that provision in the emergency statute is unconstitutional. When a court finds a part of a statute unconstitutional, the court has to decide whether to strike down the entire statute. That's the question of severability. Is this bad part severable from the rest of the apple? Well, in this case, the Republicans would say it is not severable, because after all, we would never have given the governor extraordinary powers if we could not end it, if we had no check. Therefore, I guess, they'll say, if you find this part's unconstitutional, strike down the whole statute. The reason they would make that argument is they win either way, because they want to end the emergency declaration if there's no statute. There's no authority for an emergency declaration.
As I mentioned earlier, Governor Wolf has said that Pennsylvania could lose some real advantages by taking away this disaster declaration. And as you said, Republicans haven't, don't want to totally repeal it. But what could the state lose if a disaster declaration was repealed?
Well, obviously, the first thing that we lose are all the health requirements that are still present in the green phase. Nobody thinks that we should do away with social distancing. Nobody thinks that masks are a bad idea when you're indoors. All of the 50% limits on restaurants and bars and all the rest of it, these are sensible at this point, because, as I say, the virus has not gone away and we don't have a vaccine. So all of those things would be eliminated, plus all of the other kinds of orders that the governor has issued to protect our healthcare workers from civil liability and so forth. Now, the governor is also saying that we would not be eligible for federal relief. The Republicans have contested that, and I have not actually seen the details. I don't think that that's absolutely clear.
Professor, we're almost out of time. Have about 30 seconds left. I know it's hard for you to predict, but what do you think the court is going to do in this case?
I do not think the courts will strike down the governor's authority and the emergency declaration. I think the law may be on the side of the Republicans, but I think practicality is on the side of the court. Just remember, when the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down all their orders in Wisconsin a few weeks ago, the bars in Milwaukee were packed that Friday night, and everyone was horrified. I don't think the Pennsylvania courts will want to repeat that.
Bruce Ledowitz is professor of law at Duquesne University School of Law. Professor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on Monday's show, we do this every summer where we talk about books to read. Usually it's on the beach or on vacation. This year will be books to read this summer, maybe while you're at home. That's coming up on Monday's program, so be sure to tune in.